And then to try and understand the communal areas, it's impossible to understand what's going on without working across disciplines. And then I came into contact with social scientists, with anthropologists, with historians, and suddenly I became very much more aware of the complexity of understanding conservation, understanding ecology.
Welcome to the Case for Conservation podcast. I'm your host, Andre Mardo. In 1975, biologist Paul Ehrlich said that 90% of tropical rainforests would be lost by about 2005. Although their loss has continued at a steady rate, by 2019, the figure was more like 32%. Also in the 1970s, ecologist Kenneth Watt forecast a world 11 degrees colder in the year 2000. Of course, it's well publicized that the trend is in the opposite direction and at a less severe pace. At a more modest scale, botanist John Aycox predicted in the 1950s that South Africa's Karoo, a desert-like area the size of present-day Germany, would expand into neighboring ecosystems, amounting to the desertification of millions of hectares of the country. As you'll hear in today's discussion, the Karoo in fact appears to have decreased in size. There are plenty of other examples of predictions of environmental change that proved to be completely wrong. Perhaps those making the predictions didn't spend enough time looking into the past in order to forecast the future, and perhaps they didn't consult a diverse enough pool of expertise to inform their predictions. Tim Hoffman is a professor of plant conservation at the University of Cape Town, UCT, who for decades has used a variety of techniques to understand changes in biodiversity and landscapes. I've long admired Tim for the humility with which he approaches this subject. We talked about the methods he uses, especially repeat photography, and about the role of community engagement. And Tim argues that an interdisciplinary approach to ecology and conservation is likely to give us the best idea of what's going on. This episode is focused on Southern Africa, but I'm sure you'll find the lessons are universally applicable. I started by asking Tim if he thought that conservationists were too confident in their assumptions about environmental change.
Too often there's a view that's expressed that only one kind of science is valid. Very large scale, quantitative science, often with lots of numbers, lots of data. And then that other ways of looking at the world are somehow less scientific and therefore less appropriate. So it's more a sort of a lack of openness to other interpretations of reality and other forms of investigation. So, for example, the sort of in-depth case studies which use qualitative approaches to explore the potential impact, for example, of climate change on a few land user livelihoods versus large-scale quantitative questionnaire-type surveys of the same topic. And often those in-depth case studies, which is sort of deep dive into qualitative research, are often not considered to be as valuable. And there's a very nice current debate in the journal called Society and Resources, which is centered on the Namibian conservancies and the role and importance of qualitative science in conservation research. And I think that's just emerging now. So I think it's a much deeper problem, really, about what constitutes knowledge and how to treat and value different types of knowledge and different ways in which we acquire knowledge, more than an issue about questioning assumptions in ecology and conservation.
Mm-hmm. The next question, I guess, might be slightly disjointed from this, but I wanted to also ask what it's been about your experience across your career that has kind of given you the view of things that you have. And I guess what I mean there is this appreciation for different ways of seeing things.
Yeah, so there were a few key experiences in my life. Very early on, I had the good fortune to read George Ellis's book. And George Ellis, of course, was a UCT physicist and cosmologist, and he wrote a beautiful book in 1992. I think it was published in 1994, called Before the Beginning, in which his first few chapters provide a very easy to understand, sort of written for graduate student level, in which he starts by talking about the sort of hidden nature of reality and how difficult it is to really understand reality, and how we all need mental models of this reality, which all disciplines use to understand the world. And they all apply a universal kind of learning cycle, which involves, first of all, setting up an hypothesis using knowledge that we have at present, and then determining its consequences, and then testing the consequences against this evidence, sometimes with experiments, but not always. And this requires, as George says, an openness to possibilities. So that book really had a major impact on me when I very first started doing my PhD. And I still have the book, and I still return to it every year or so just to remind myself about that. But then I was involved very early on as well. Soon after my PhD, I was involved in a project to investigate John Aycock's expanding Karoo hypothesis. Mm-hmm. So John worked in the 1940s and 50s, and he published his Felt Types of South Africa in the 1950s, in which he argued and produced four very beautiful maps of South Africa and what it looked like before colonial settlement, what it looked like in the 1950s, and what it will look like in 2053. Mm. And he also had a final map in which he said, if you followed his approach to rangeland management, then this is what it could look like. And in that 2053 map, his projection for the future, he argued that the Karoo would have expanded all the way into the Northern Free State province, and that there would be desertification. And in the vacuum created by this northeastwards moving Karoo, this desert vegetation, there'd be complete desert. And so this expanding Karoo hypothesis held sway in the sort of ecological literature for 50 years. Mm. And when I did my undergraduate, this is what was taught. My task in 1989 was to try and answer that question, is the Karoo expanding? And so it as soon as I started working on this, and I used repeat photographs for the first time then, mm-hmm. it became very clear very quickly that, in fact, this wasn't happening. And if anything, the opposite was true. There was much more grassiness in the Eastern Karoo in 1989, 1990 than there was in 1953 and in the earlier photographs. Mm-hmm. So I started to argue then that, the expanding Karoo hypothesis was an assumption that didn't hold. Mm-hmm. And this took me then into a sort of another project a few years later into then trying to understand, well, what is the extent of degradation in South Africa? So I worked across South Africa and focused then on the communal areas, because that seemed to be the place where degradation, overgrazing, erosion, and so on seemed to be greatest. Mm-hmm. And then to try and understand the communal areas, it's impossible to understand what's going on without working across disciplines. And then I came into contact with social scientists, with anthropologists, with historians. And suddenly, I became very much more aware of the complexity of understanding conservation, understanding ecology. And then finally, I joined UCT about 20 years ago, where I had to teach. I had never taught before. I had to teach, and I had to lead a series of research programs. And then this kind of concentrates your mind, and it forces you to think much more carefully about knowledge itself and how one learns and what the assumptions are of different disciplines. Natural science, biological science, very demanding, and it requires training in all the basics, lots of field work, learning floras, learning faunas, learning about interactions. It's technically increasingly more and more demanding. You think about all the technical issues around spatial analysis. Mm-hmm. And then there's all the statistical modeling that's becoming increasingly important. So you end up focusing quite narrowly within a very, very small discipline with colleagues who are all thinking very similarly and producing evidence, producing information very much along the same lines And there's so much to learn. It's so demanding that you really start talking amongst yourselves. And it's quite rare then to get any kind of input from outside. Mm-hmm. You tend to become a bit, I feel, a bit lulled into thinking that this is the only way to really understand the world. But if you're working in a larger sort of interdisciplinary project, suddenly you have other disciplines to contend with, and they can be very disruptive to your views. They can really challenge the way you think about things because they bring different theory and very rich theory as well. Take, for example, the anthropological sciences or the social sciences. That bring also a whole range of other methods, methods which involve actually talking to people. And there's many different ways in which one engages with people. There's quantitative social science research. There's qualitative research. They're also generally very socially, very progressive in their sort of fundamental views of nature and of society. And they focus on a range of non-biological issues such as poverty and power, social justice, gender issues, and so on. And that kind of really challenges you to think much more broadly, for example, about, say, conservation, where you as a conservation planner or as a biologist might think very precisely and very carefully about the quantitative aspects of richness and climate and where you should put reserves in terms of future climate change extrapolations and so on. And you do your best in that field, but you don't think about, well, who's living there and how they're making a livelihood and what would the impact be and who's making these decisions for them, and why not be much more inclusive and find ways to accommodate broader social needs and social issues. Mm-hmm. And what is the history of these areas, and who are insiders, who are outsiders, and who are the elites within these communities who are making decisions as well? Who's really benefiting from the provision of a new reserve or a land reform program? And these are questions that you as a biologist have spent most of your life really learning the technical and statistical skills and the biological skills. You don't pay much attention to. They're difficult, very complicated, mm-hmm. but they're critical and they are important. Mm-hmm. And it helps then to work in these broader teams. And it helps if you get on with your colleagues from the other disciplines. Mm-hmm. And especially helps if you have a question. And that, in my experience, has been one of the most difficult things, is to come up with a shared question which these broad interdisciplinary teams can all buy into and really feel they have some sort of ownership over it, and can really feel as if they're part of, and that they can bring their particular set of skills to solve some of these pressing problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this interaction between natural sciences and social sciences, I know that a lot of natural scientists don't make the effort to do that, and I can see the benefits of it. But I also just wonder, do you think that the social scientists are learning as much from people like you as you're learning from them? Or do you get the sense that it's a one-way process, that their opinions are kind of cast in stone and they can't really be moved one way or another?
I've been very fortunate in that I met two, and others, but especially two colleagues who had a big influence on my thinking. And I met them very early on in my career. Ben Cousins is a friend of mine still, and Rick Rode is also a friend of mine. And with Rick, anyway, the connection was around repeat photography, because Rick was doing his PhD in Namibia, and he was interested in how environments had changed and what the impacts of these changes had been for people and for the environment. And so he reached out and said, this is in the mid-90s, would I be interested in accompanying him in some field work? And I spent a couple of weeks with him, and we subsequently have published a number of papers together in Namibia and South Africa, often trying to grapple with these issues of social and natural science and the crossovers between the two. And, when you're doing repeat photography over 2 or 3 weeks, you spend a lot of time in the car together, and you have a lot of conversations, which sometimes can get pretty animated. And Rick has had a massive influence on just the thinking that people from these other disciplines bring, especially issues that challenge your basic assumptions about how the world works,
mm-hmm.
and make you think about the past and make you think about sort of social differentiation. And then, you know, Ben's work has been around, he was the start of the program for land and agrarian studies, now called the Institute for Poverty, Land and Agrarian Studies at the University of the Western Cape. And so he's interested in land reform and all the implications of that. And he put me in touch with other colleagues. And before I knew it, I was working in Rimfasmark, which is just across the Orange River at Kakamas. And suddenly I was involved with land reform issues. So this is the first land restitution case. And I was asked to set up a monitoring program using repeat photography of Rimfasmark to try and understand what the impact of people returning to this area, what the impact might be in the decades going forward. And so I set up this little monitoring program that I went back every 10 years or so. And this, of course, brought me into contact with people from Rimfasmark. Mm-hmm. And they'd been kicked off the land in 1974-75 in the most brutal way. And, traveling with the returnees, I was there in the week that many came back. It wasn't easy in 94 to get down to the Orange River. It's quite bad roads. And so we gave people a lift to their former homes. So Rimfasmark had become part of the South African Defence Force, and they had used the area for a sort of artillery and target practice area, and their homes were in ruins. And going down to the Orange River with some of the former inhabitants, like Wimbill and Fuss, and sitting on the sort of ruins of his father's ox wagon that he had arrived there in the 1930s. And going to his parents' graves and paying his respects and sharing with us sort of locations where he had grown up and where he had herded livestock and where he had got a hiding from his dad for letting the livestock go off on their own. And appreciating the depth of knowledge about the landscape, about the history of the landscape, about how to use the landscape, just being exposed to these different ways of knowing about the land, knowing about the history of conservation, because for that 20 years between 74 and 1994, mm-hmm. it had become incorporated in not only SANDF, but also as part of a national park.
Mm-hmm.
So, we have this very complex history in South Africa, and my colleagues were great teachers in helping me understand some of this complexity of this history and sensitizing me to some of the details of it, for which I'm very grateful. And it wasn't just them. There were many other people who have passed through South Africa with whom I had the good fortune of talking to as well. And some were, extremely challenging and very critical of the work that conservation has done and is still doing in many parts of Africa. So it is very useful to me to have that perspective, as well as, of course, being at the University of Cape Town and being exposed to some of the best conservation scientists.
How do those communities feel about, a bunch of whiteys walking around and taking photos and taking notes? Do they welcome it, or do you think there's any resentment there? How do you kind of manage those relationships?
That's a good question, because it does raise the issue of how you relate to your research subjects, and you're very aware all the time that you are an outsider and you're coming in and you have a tremendous amount to learn, for example, just from sort of livestock herders. I mean, to manage a herd of 50 or 100 animals of sheep and goats every day walking in the hot sun over pretty tough terrain, managing all the veterinary stuff that you have to manage, managing predators, managing animal husbandry, birthing, managing your herd in terms of economics of it. there's a tremendous amount to learn, and this is without any real state support as well. So in general, people have been very accommodating, very supportive, very welcoming, especially in the early years when we first arrived. Many of the older people in the community welcomed us in. Mm-hmm. We tried to link our research, which can be a very extractive process. We try to link it with some kind of development component as well. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult because most funders very rarely would link research to development. Their call for proposals didn't say, you know, this is for research into the impacts of climate change on the drylands of Southern Africa, mm-hmm. and how to couple that with the real investment in the development of the communities within which you're working. Mm-hmm. And here's a 50-50 split in the budget, which, you know, you could use to help build the infrastructure or build the institutional capacity of these communities. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't work like that. And so you're often coming in, speaking to farmers, taking up their time, or doing household surveys, taking up people's time. Usually are paying for the enumerators, for people to go around, but paying for information is a tricky business in social science. Research has to be thought about very carefully. Our way around it has been to just sort of spend a lot of time in the community. You know, there was a period about 14 years or so where either I or other people in the research group would go up every month. We would employ on a full-time basis people from the community, and we still are employing people from the community. And we also got involved in the school, helping with various school projects, whatever funds we could find, try to support the farmers' unions in some capacity or other. Mm. They certainly appreciated these small contributions, and in that way, it was a demonstration of our commitment to the community. Mm-hmm.
Very early in my career, I had the opportunity to, also in the Karoo, but a bit further south from where you were.
Yes.
And I had the opportunity to interview over a period of a few months about 20 farmers. It was about the presence or absence of the riverine rabbit, which is an endangered species in the area. And then extending that to asking them about which animals they still saw around their parts of the country and which ones had disappeared over the generations, that kind of thing. And I realized very quickly that you can't rush that. You know, you got to just like put the entire day aside. Inevitably, I would be invited for lunch and the discussion would go on. You know, the questionnaire would be finished before lunch. And then the really interesting stuff would come out during and after lunch. And I love that. It's one of the events in my career that I cherish the most, you know, over that short period of time, very early in the process. But it was fascinating and so useful.
Yes, I mean, don't forget, these are also communities in the Makwaland about which very little has been written, mm-hmm. about which, you know, very few people have had the privilege of really experiencing life in these rural communities. Mm-hmm. So, some of my earliest memories, too, are sitting around in the evenings and around the fireplace and listening to the stories of the old days, because this village sort of was established around the early part of the 1900s. And so there were people when we first started who still remembered school life in the 1930s and 1940s and what it was like to live out on the stock posts, mm-hmm. and to walk to school for a few hours each morning in the bitter cold, frosty mornings, mm-hmm. With just a threadbare little shirt on and short pants and bare feet and catching rabbits. And we also, again, through work that and ideas that Rick brought to the project, we also developed a sort of a community photograph project where Rick gave people from the village these disposable cameras. It's a fairly common thing to do now, but in those years, in the 1990s, it was quite novel. Mm-hmm. And we worked closely with one of the young talents, a young woman called Sophia Klasser, who we subsequently, you know, gave her digital cameras as well to use. And she amassed sort of 1,500 photographs of village life. She was a brilliant photographer, and she was able to attend all the major functions in the village when we weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
And she was able to really get up close, and she had a wonderful talent for framing pictures. And Rick produced a book in the end of Sophia's Fakey's photographs with essays by various colleagues around the sort of more social aspects of the village and so on. So that was another way in which we could sort of get, you know, a much deeper understanding of village life and what happened in the village on a sort of day-to-day basis.
Getting back to repeat photography, which you mentioned earlier, could you explain exactly what that is, and then also, you know, how it has factored into the work that you've been doing over the decades?
It's a fairly simple explanation. Repeat photography is sort of the at heart, it's using or it's finding and taking an historical photograph into the field with you. And now these photographs date from the earliest that we've worked with are from 1876 in Namibia. And we usually take the cutoff around about 2000 because, you know, that's the sort of date that we feel is manageable, because also then after 2000, we start to get into digital cameras and so on. So often we have these old prints or old slides or old glass plates or whatever, and we make a print of it, and we take it into the field, and then we try and stand on exactly the same place. And sometimes it can take a long time to find the exact place. So we try and stand on exactly the same place as the original photograph from where it was taken. And then we retake that photograph, often slightly wider angle lens, often the same angle, same sort of focal length. And we take a panorama because we're also setting it up as a monitoring station for future monitoring, for future measures of environmental change. And when, once we've taken the photograph, and we then often walk, as we say, walk into the image. We often divide it up into different landform units. So if, for example, there's a little river or dry river bed or a river terrace or a sandy plain or a rocky slope, and we then document the plant species composition in those different landform units and give them a sort of basic percentage cover, and try and use and extract all of our sort of ecological knowledge that we have to try and understand from what we see in that image to what we see in the landscape at the time, to try and sort of interpret what's there. What are those trees that we saw in that picture in 1876? Are they still there? What's come in their place? And often this information helps you to understand the sort of trajectory of change. Are you heading toward more cover, improved environmental condition, or are you seeing something that's reflecting from our understanding, our ecological understanding, is it reflecting more a degradation trajectory?
Mm-hmm.
And then we go back to the office after we've taken as many as we can on that particular field trip, and then we match them as perfectly as we can. And then we zoom in to these images. It sometimes helps with the field notes. You then zoom in to the images, and then you can count things if you need to. For example, aloes in the desert. You can count individuals as well. We have a wonderful paper on the cycads, a sort of collapse of cycads on privately owned land as a result of being stolen, we think, and sold. So you can get quantitative information out of these images and not just sort of more qualitative changes in grasses, trees, and shrubs.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you have enough of them, say in the deserts or say in the succulent Karoo, or we often work at a biome level, and if you have enough replication, you have enough photographs from a particular region or a biome, you can start to then summarize for that biome sort of what has happened over the last 50, 100 or so years. And that's what we sort of at the stage now of doing, is trying to make more sort of generalizable conclusions about what's happening across Southern Africa from what we're seeing in the repeat photographs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're not without their problems because each image is unique. It's not like an aerial photograph where you have a particular, you know, you can choose your area. You can 1 hectare or 100 hectares, and then you can count things in that. This is much more nuanced in the sense that each image is different. Sometimes it's of many hundreds of hectares, sometimes only have a very small area. Mm-hmm. So you have to be a little bit open to these nuanced interpretations while still trying to bring a sort of a basic rigor to the quantification or even to the more in-depth sort of analysis of that particular image.
Mm-hmm.
But what they do give you is they give you a time machine. How else do you go back 100 years or 130 years? You can go back with sort of more quantitative information. You can go back using remote sensing 20, maybe 30, 40 years at most. Botanical surveys, it'll take you back to the sort of 50s, maybe to the 60s. But, you know, how do you go back further? This is one way to do that and use to create sort of baseline conditions. This is what the vegetation or the landscape looked like in 1920 or 1900.
Mm-hmm.
And today it's changed to look like this. And what can we say about these trajectories as a result of this change?
Mm-hmm.
So, and what does it mean for climate change? What does it mean for the climate change models that are being proposed about what we can expect in the next 50 years?
Yeah.
Are we seeing that the trajectories of change are in fact, you know, do they correspond closely to those trajectories that have been proposed for the next 50 years? And then this is how we've tried to use these images as well. Within this, the group that I work, the Plant Conservation Unit, we're trying to focus on this sort of past, present, future continuum, and also in the context of sort of climate change projections.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned degradation or improvement in the landscape. I guess what you mean is like degradation is more or less associated with the loss of vegetation cover, right? And improvement is at least typically associated with gain of vegetation cover. But then you also mentioned earlier that ACOX's predictions were wrong. It seems that they were wrong, right? That vegetation is actually increasing over time. So what does that all mean? And also in the context of climate change, does that mean that the increase in vegetation cover doesn't necessarily mean improvement? What is the landscape telling you, and what are the implications for climate change?
So we look at vegetation cover is certainly a very important parameter from which to start saying something about in which direction is the vegetation heading, or where it has come from.
Mm-hmm.
It's one measure. I mean, one has to be careful, of course, because if you have, for example, Prosopis mesquite, you're going to see a tremendous increase in cover in the landscape, especially along the river courses. But that's not necessarily, you know, it's not something to be valued because, you know, a thick, dense stand of mesquite is actually detrimental for example, for livestock production, for water service provision, and for many other ecosystem services. So, but in general, a change in the vegetation cover, an increase in the vegetation cover of natural vegetation is generally considered to be a sign that, you know, there has been, you know, an improvement in the vegetation because more cover means less erosion, usually greater infiltration, changed hydrological conditions. And there's a whole lot of ecological parameters that are linked to just basic changes in cover. But there's more than cover. It's also species composition. And the Karoo, for example, those who work in the field of rangeland ecology can look at a Karoo site and say, okay, well, it's dominated by this, this, and this species. And this suggests to me that it's a patch of vegetation that's improving because it's got these highly palatable tussock grasses that bind the soil and they have a very high grazing value. Or you can go to another site that's full of shrubs and they are unpalatable, they drop their leaves, they are not very useful for livestock production. So there are ways to interpret the composition of the landscape in terms of its sort of ecological condition. And, you know, the rangeland ecologists have worked out over decades now, particularly, you know, how to do that. And so that's why when you're using this technique of repeat photography, you need to really walk into that image and you need to you need to do some, you know, basic ecological sort of field work and try and use all your knowledge to understand where you are in this sort of succession trajectory of recovery or of degradation. So that's sort of the way in which one would use your sort of ecological knowledge to understand these changes. And in general, what we're finding, and we've written this paper called Rethinking Catastrophe, because some of the very early climate change projections suggested that, you know, with the increased temperatures which have occurred and which are likely to occur at a greater sort of rate and go up to as much as 7-degree increase in the sort of central Kalahari region in the next 100 years, which is going to be pretty catastrophic if that does occur. You know, and the models generally have been focused on the sort of changes in climate, especially changes in temperature and rainfall. There have been some early attempts to ask, well, what does that mean for the vegetation? And these are very brave colleagues who've proposed sort of what we can expect Southern African biomes to look like in the next 50 to 100 years. And the early models were quite dramatic. It's great for us because we have sort of an hypothesis. We have something against which to interpret, against which to try and understand the changes that we see in this historical imagery, in the historical trajectories. We have now a statement about what it's going to be like in the future. And while we've sort of set up a little bit, they're kind of a little bit straw men in a way, because the models have moved on and they're much more subtle now. But still, they're very useful for us. And in general, our results that we've proposed in this paper called Rethink Catastrophe, our work suggests that you know, there are many areas where these projections that were for, you know, very degraded landscapes with very little vegetation cover, that doesn't seem to be upheld by what we've seen in the historical photographs, at least to date. What we see much more is that cover is either quite stable in the Karoo, or if anything, it's improved slightly towards the eastern parts of the sort of in the Nama Karoo around Middelburg and Craddock and so on. There's been an increase in cover, mostly, and especially of grasses in the subtropical thickets, and especially in the eastern parts of the country, there's been an increase in woody plant cover. Often associated with sort of acacias, acacia karoo or vachellia karoo now, the sweet thorn, broadleaf woodlands have also come in. And so, you know, these projections, the early projections, don't seem to have held up for the most part. In the Cape Peninsula as well, for example, where fire has been suppressed, we're seeing also an increase in forest cover. I mean, if you look at early pictures of Blinkwater Ravine above Camps Bay, for example, the area was burnt very frequently. And so you find very few trees in Blinkwater Ravine. You find lots of exposed rock cover. You find a lot of petaloid monocots. You find Babartias and Irids and all the Watsonias. You don't see them that often anymore. Instead, now you have forest trees, you have shrubs, you have proteas all in the mix. And so it's a very different landscape today because of the suppression of fire. And our work has called in to play the role that land use, especially the role of fire and grazing, has played in changing the Southern African environments. For example, one also needs to combine this repeat photography work with more the historical work, what you'd find in the archives. So here you want to look at, for example, the agricultural census records, where the so-called blue books have got livestock numbers for each of them. I think it's 350 magisterial districts in the country going back into the 19th century. And if we look at this census data, we can see that from the mid-1930s to the present, the number of sheep in the Karoo, for example, has declined from around 11 million to something like 3 million. And so there's been this tremendous reduction in grazing. If we also look at the climate record, we see that rainfall, for the most part, has actually increased in the Karoo, especially in the early summer rain, which favors grasses. So one uses the combination of data to try and understand and try and interpret the sort of drivers of change that you see in this historical photography.
So those sheep numbers from 11 million down to 3 million, that's more or less what is the time period there?
The sort of wool boom and the peak livestock production for merino sheep was around the 1930s. And the last census that we have reliable data for is around 2007. Yeah, 70, 80-year period that we've seen this. And goats have absolutely plummeted. Horses, mules, donkeys, of course, which were used in the first part of the 20th century for transport and for cultivation and plowing and so on, they've almost disappeared over most of the Karoo. And they would have all been using, you know, the production from shrubs and grasses. What we don't have a good handle on is how wildlife has taken up that space that we've now seen vacated by small stock. There aren't the records. Some of our colleagues have worked hard in the Eastern Cape to develop these data sets, but we don't have it nationally about how many, you know, springbuck or kudu or whatever you have across all of these areas.
There are those stories, I don't know how true these are, but there are those stories about how farmers in the area would see incredibly large herds of springbuck passing, you know, in the hundreds of thousands. If those are true, or if they approach truth, then it would seem that even the springbok numbers have decreased quite considerably over that time.
Yes, one hears about these kind of large migratory springbok herds, and there's been quite a bit of work. And again, this shows the sort of value of historical ecology in trying to understand these pre-colonial environments. And so there's been some work looking at old newspaper cuttings from the sort of late 1800s and even from the more central Karoo areas, and have tried to reconstruct where all these populations of migratory springbok, where they originated, where they were moving to, and how many animals there were. And so there's been this reconstruction for the 19th century of these large springbok migratory herds. And yes, one does read about sort of, you know, millions of animals or many thousands of animals moving the whole day or for more than a day through one location, and the devastation that they caused. But the last sort of major trek, I think, is from 1899. And I think Cronwright Schreiner, who was a member of parliament in the Cape, wrote a book on the sort of migratory springbok, in which he describes this last trek of springbok in the Karoo. As the frontier started to close with the creation of fencing for livestock production, so it sort of corralled these large herds into, it forced them to move in certain directions. Mm-hmm. And that is what this environmental history work is trying to get at, is where these animals were, how many animals there were, and where were they moving from and to.
Mm-hmm. And your work with communities, I guess they've been able to fill in some of these gaps as well, right? You alluded to that already. So you've got the repeat photography to give you some idea, but then they're able to give you at least some of the color to the story, I suppose.
So that's the other thing that one needs to do. Besides walking through the image and sort of getting, using all your ecological information, ecological knowledge about what's happened, it helps tremendously if you have access to the landowners, to people who've lived on the land. It's not so easy because, you know, either the parents or the original landowner have either died or they've moved away or the farm's been sold. And, you know, the last 20, 30 years have been a period of tremendous change in the Karoo, especially the consolidation of many small farms that's characterized the Karoo in the 1950s, the sort of subdivision of what were once very large farms into smaller and smaller units in the 1950s, and has gone now in the other direction, where many landowners have abandoned their properties and have sold up and they've become amalgamated.
Mm-hmm.
But they often don't have the knowledge that the original landowners would have had. But if they have any records, and that's not all that common, but if they had sort of livestock records or what their parents did on the farms or where people were farming, even in the communal areas, for example, many of the farmers have a very good sort of spatial map of different family groups and where their stock posts were located and who had rights to which areas, especially on the cropland areas. And so you can reconstruct these large-scale farm maps where different people were farming, and they give you a flavor of also of how many animals there were in a herd, mm-hmm. How people utilized the landscape, the kind of institutional arrangements, the institutional rules about moving across that landscape, who was in charge, how they made decisions about who could move where and do what, when. The role of donkeys in their lives. So it's tremendous information that you can get out of talking to landowners. But a lot of that, like a lot of the traditional medicines, the herbalists, a lot of that is disappearing. For example, when we first started working in the village of Polzik, there were something like 4 or 5 herbalists. Some of them very successful and very sort of professional as well. And you would find people coming to the village from, you know, the villages in sort of middle of the Namaqualand, and the people would come from Friedendal to the south or from Uppington to the north to consult with the herbalists, the bosses, doctors, as they call them in the village. Today, no one is practicing. They've either moved away or they've passed away. And so all that information was contained in the hands of the herbalists to treat a whole range of different illnesses is gone. That happened in the time that I've been working there. There have been efforts to try and consolidate or try and at least record that information, but a lot of it is gone. And there's a lot of it still inherent within the community of people who would treat minor coughs and colds and aches and pains and so on. They would know, and there's still people in the village who would know where to go to, which plant to use for which ailment, but that deep specialized knowledge has largely disappeared from certainly this village. I think it exists in other places, but not in this particular village.
And the village continues, right? So do you think the reason for the knowledge disappearing is just because of outside influences and the younger generations being less interested in that kind of thing, or not interested enough to, as you say, get in depth as much as those herbalists were?
Yeah, it's an interesting question as to how this knowledge disappears, because certainly the herbalists that I came to know saw themselves as very independent, and almost their reputation was based on their personality. And so they didn't really take on apprentices.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't really pass on that information to anybody else. And for many, they had been herbalists for decades, and their reputation was centered on them as a person and their particular knowledge, which they and they only had. And it was sort of, you know, directly associated with them, with their name.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was never really passed on. I didn't have an apprentice. They didn't share that information. They were very happy to talk to me about things, but I never wrote it down. I never, and you know, even if I did write it down, their actual practice was much more than just, you know, which plant do you use for which ailment. And it was a whole system of exploration of disease and illness, which they would use to try and understand the patient's problem.
Mm-hmm.
And often spending many hours with the patient, trying to understand the much deeper source of the issue, mm-hmm. often associated with sort of spiritual content as well, spiritual elements. It was much more around, you know, what's your social circumstances, who's in your family, what's happening in your personal life.
Mm-hmm.
I got a sense that this was an important part of the healing process.
Mm-hmm.
After which it might be that, you know, here is something you should take. Here's a potion or a concoction that you should take to help you. But it was embedded within a much richer understanding of sort of bewitchment or bewitching and sort of spell casting and spiritual elements that I realized that as an ecologist, it was beyond my realm. And that's why I was only too happy to have, the more social science sort of elements or colleagues come in and work with that stuff. Trying to understand the deeper sort of healing process that herbalists bring to the table is a very different way of trying to explore knowledge.
Okay, that's it for this episode, but next month's edition will also feature community conservation. I'll be talking to Zimbabwean conservationist and researcher Lochran Trail about the differences in viewpoint and values between local communities on the one hand and the more loudly expressed opinions of people in countries where community conservation might not be very well understood. We speak mostly about trophy hunting as an example of these disparities.